This is the Horse Radio Network.
What a beautiful day for horses in the morning.
Good morning, everyone. This is Glenn the Geek, and you're listening to Horses in the Morning for May 24th, episode 1703. We are on vacation right now, but we have a new episode for you today. When we were looking at who to do some special one-on-one interviews with, we were looking at all kinds of amazing people. Jamie did Pat Roberts on Monday, and if you missed that, go back and take a listen to it. It was well worth it. I thought I would stay a little closer to home and speak with someone you all know and love. I have heard her amazing stories of her family and her early years, but you have not. She is one of the smartest, most fun, and opinionated people I know. Plus, she is part owner of the Horse Radio Network and has become one of our dearest friends. Her grandmother was a princess who escaped communism, her father a genius. But let's let her tell her stories. Today is all about the early life of Dr. Wendy Ying. Well, hi, Wendy. Thank you for joining us this morning on this one-on-one.
Hi, Glenn. Hi, everybody. I'm glad to be here.
Well, you know, you are a favorite of the listeners. I hear more comments about Wendy and how they love Wendy. And I thought when we were deciding what one-on-ones we wanted to do for vacation horses in the morning, I was looking at all these professional riders and stuff, and I said, wait a minute. Everybody seems to love Wendy, and you've led a fascinating, if not crazy, life. So I thought, well, let's get Wendy on and find out to kind of a "This Is Your Life" story.
Okay.
Kind of a equestrian legends.
You're gonna be disappointed because it's not as crazy and as you think. I think it's all myth.
But
and
it's
legend.
Fascinating. I think it's fascinating. You know, especially your family. I mean, you have a fascinating family, that's for sure.
Oh, yeah.
I can't figure it out. So maybe I'll have a little better idea when we're done here today. And we hope that everybody enjoys this. So let's start at the beginning. Let's rewind and go back to where were you born?
I was born in Lawrence, Massachusetts.
And that's right near Boston.
Lawrence,
right?
General Hospital. Yep. It's like 20 minutes north of Boston.
So you're up there in the Beverly Myopia Hunt Country area.
It was like Andover.
Yeah,
so it was
okay.
Like north of there.
Now, you're obviously Asian, but not all Asian. So which part was which?
My dad is Chinese, and he came here when he was 16.
Did he come here by himself?
To go to 16? MIT. He came with his brother, who was 17.
They both got into MIT?
Yep.
At 16?
Well, you know, they start them, they're on a different schedule for their high school, you know, for the Chinese and the European kids. So they were, my grandmother sent them off to boarding school in Switzerland at a school that my grandfather had gone to. And so they went there for a year. And these kids are from Hong Kong, right? I mean, Hong Kong weather's like Florida.
Oh, yeah.
And they were in Switzerland.
Middle of snow country.
And I think, yeah, I know. And I can't remember. I think they were supposed to go to the college that my grandfather went to, the engineering college in Switzerland, but they didn't speak Swiss and the school was only taught in German. So they had to go to this school first for a year and learn German.
Did he?
Yeah, he speaks great German.
So now, and your dad, okay, so he was 16 when he left China. Obviously, if they went to boarding school and things,
he was 15. This 15. Is a great story, actually. Okay. This is a great story. He didn't tell me this till I was a grown-up, or I just don't remember. But this is like, he was born in the 50s, right? So I guess it was like 60s. My grandmother put him on a ship, and they had all of their clothes like made for them and made in different sizes as they grow. Because my grandmother's a little crazy, my Chinese grandmother, or I should say was, she just passed away a couple years ago. But she, I mean, I know she knows they have clothes in Switzerland that the kids could buy, but they're never good enough. Like, you know, they have to be, she's very controlling.
Did she come from money? Were they money? Where'd the money come from to do private schools?
This is the thing. We don't know. We don't know the real facts.
Oh.
She says her story is that she's a princess and that her family owned all this land and she could walk all day and she'd never be off the edge of her property. And that may be true.
Not in Hong Kong, but in China itself?
In China. And then the communists took over and took everything. She escaped from the communists.
There's a story.
And that's a good story, too. This is a good one. She had four. My grandfather was away on business. And the kids they're all 1 year apart. So the oldest one is my uncle Richard. He was 4, and then my father was 3, and then Lisa was 2, and Julia was 1. So she had 4 babies. And of course, this is typical Ying fashion. She was in denial that the communists were really going to come and didn't make any plans. But then, you know, okay, they're coming. So she needs to leave, right, and get to Hong Kong. So she gets on, there's a train leaving and people are like scrambling to get on this train. And her other part of her family, you know, they took the rich people or the landowners or whatever, they took them and arrested them. So her brother and her uncle were like hauled off to jail and they were actually in jail for their rest of their lives pretty much. And so she took all the kids and she couldn't get on the train. So she shoved them through the window to somebody else. And then she went around the back and said, I have to get on that train. My kids are on the train. And they let her on.
She was lucky if she in fact was a princess that she got away.
I know. Well, she said that the people in the town liked their family because they were good to their family, good to the people. Like, you know, the way the system in China ran before was like...
It was like, you know, fiefdoms, wasn't it? Like,
yeah, but also they were in the country. They weren't in the city. So it was kind of like owning a great big farm, like a plantation.
It was almost like the castles were in England, where you had the town that was around the family and everybody worked for the family.
And everybody worked for the family. Yeah. So... they didn't actually kill her family because they had a good relationship with the townspeople. The one, like, they were tyrants. So, and that's the story she tells. You have to remember that when when she tells these stories, it may or may not be that way. It could be that could be a very exaggerated.
That's a Ying thing too, by the way.
That's a Ying thing too. Yeah, just imagine me telling the story. So it might not be that way at all, but that's what our family has been led to believe.
Isn't that funny? So now, obviously she still had, I'm still stuck on this. She had money when she got to Hong Kong somehow.
Because my grandfather was an engineer and he had a job with a German engineering company.
Okay.
So... they had income from that. And then you know, when she left, she met him in Hong Kong, but they never went back. And supposedly, even like, I guess 10 years ago, she made my uncle go with her because she said she buried the family fortune in the backyard or blah, blah, blah. So she wanted to go back and get her gold, but they didn't find it.
I was going to say, did she ship you a big box full of gold?
No, they didn't.
It's still in the mail.
Must be buried really deep.
Well, that's fascinating. So your grandfather was an engineer, and then your father takes off this young age to go to Switzerland to school, and then he starts in MIT. I mean, talk about getting
into... That's a great story, too.
Okay, well, yeah, because MIT is like the master engineering school.
So he was not really happy with the weather in Switzerland. I think that's where I get it from.
I'd be like you living in Switzerland.
Yeah. And he was like, you know, kind of, okay, I'm out from under my domineering mother's thumb. Right. So he was kind of looking at these, like little kids do. They look at different colleges and they have a book that you can look through and see the different colleges. And he saw this one and he said, oh, look, it's zero application fee for Chinese students. So there's no application fee. It was free. So I said, I'm going to send my application in there because it's free. And he told his brother, and he said, and you know, I always say, like, we Chinese are the Jews of the Asian world because we love a bargain. So they're like, oh, it's free. Let's just send in our thing. So they sent it in, and then they got into that, and then they got into the college that they were supposed to go to in Switzerland. And my dad told his professor that he had gotten into MIT, but he didn't know what it was. I mean, he was like 16 years old. You don't know that stuff then, right?
Yeah. It's like, just the college. Yeah.
Just the college. And when they didn't have internet. It's not like now, right?
Yeah, I couldn't look it up.
Yeah. And so his professor said, you what? You got into MIT? And at that school, there was also his host family. They had host families there. So he had a host family, and they actually were from Boston. They're named the Vanderbeams. I actually grew up with thinking, you know, they're like, they always stayed very close. They're like my second grandparents, these people. And when my dad told them that he got into MIT, they went crazy. They're like, you have to go. And my grandmother was so pissed. She was so pissed when she found out they went to MIT.
Because they didn't go to the school that that they were supposed to go to.
Yeah, she had a plan. She had a plan, and everybody needs to stick to the plan. I'm sure there was a letter in her own blood that she was pissed off that she didn't spend all this time, blah, 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 for them to go off to America.
I could just picture this woman, too.
Yeah.
Was she about your height?
She's littler than me.
Oh, really? Wow. I could just picture her mightiness.
She was mighty. And she was very... she was very fit even into her old age. She did a lot of Tai Chi.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, she was really.
Oh, so she could back up her little mightiness.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. She, and Chinese people don't feel bad about beating their kids.
All right. So that, so your dad heads off to Switzerland and then off to MIT at the young age. And obviously was pretty smart to get in the first place. You know, he kind of was a brilliant guy, wasn't he?
He was a super brilliant guy.
He went to MIT and then graduated as an engineer?
Yeah, and then he and his brother started a company called ATEX. And it was like a... it used computers to set type. So, like, really...
Like early typesetting for magazines and stuff?
Yeah, it's almost, I sometimes think, I can't believe they did this. Because the only thing they had before they invented this system was you had to go put the little, you know, like the Gutenberg
press. I did.
Right?
We had a friend in Connecticut that had the typesets, and we used to love to go in and play with the little metal things and put the letters together.
Yeah, that's how they used to do newspapers.
Yeah, that's right.
So this was actually the first step before desktop publishing. Like, he is the murderer of the typewriter.
That's funny.
So before you had to set the space between letters.
I knew about this and looked this up. And do you know what year he started it? Could it have been 1973?
Oh, yeah. ATEX?
Yeah.
I think so. But like they started... I think that's when he started it
because I found the history of it.
Oh, great.
He's founded in 1973 by Douglas Drain and Charles and Richard Ying.
Yeah.
Graduates of MIT who had a new idea for electronic composition systems. And it looks like this company's still in business.
Well, they sold it to Eastman Kodak.
Okay. Got it.
And my dad actually passed away like the year before Kodak went out of business. And I was like, oh, I'm glad he didn't have to see that. But yeah, so they sold it to Eastman Kodak, and I guess it could still be in business.
It's still in business. They claim to have over $1 billion worth of software installed worldwide. And they develop advertising, editorial, and web content management systems.
Oh, great.
And that's the same company. So apparently, I don't know if it got sold. I didn't look if it got sold again. You know, Eastman Kodak probably sold it out to whoever came next.
Yeah.
But yeah, they have 1,500 employees, I think, the way it looks. So your dad would be proud.
He would be really proud. And you know what? He loved, that's why he stayed up on computers, because he really loved the way it was evolving. like he loved desktop publishing and he loved like making web pages and he loves fonts. He's like a crazy font.
Well, yeah,
I mean,
in that business, he would have loved fonts, right? Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know if you found this when you're doing your search, but he started a company called myfonts.com.
Oh, really?
Do you know myfonts?
Yes, I know what that is. I've gotten fonts from them before.
You have? Oh, good. Well, this is a funny story about him, too. He loves fonts. And when he started this myfonts.com, people didn't really, you know, you had to be into publishing to know what a font is, right? Because back then people didn't know, like a normal person wouldn't know or care what font you're using. And so he lived in Silicon Valley at the time, and he loved to, you know, be up on the latest Apple stuff. And this is way before Apple was big. This is like, you know, Steve Jobs had, like, I think they had the tiny Mac.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but my dad loved to go to the Apple show because it was in San Francisco I think it was at Embarcadero Center or something. So he loved every year to go to the Apple show and see all this stuff because it's like a toy store for geeks. So then one year I remember he's like, oh, you'll never believe it. I started this font company. And because I think he did the webpage himself. And then he met somebody that developed this thing. You know how you can type in, you can take a picture of the font and you put it on myfonts.com and it'll tell you what font it is?
Yes.
So he met some guy that developed that at the Apple show the year before, and then they started this thing and they made the website. And he was super excited because he got a booth at the Apple show. He wasn't just like somebody there. He was like a VIP at the Apple show.
I love the fact that your dad was such a geek. I love that. I think I would have got along well with your dad. I wish I had gotten to meet him.
I know. You would have gotten along great. I think that was in the 90s because I think I was in vet school because I remember going to visit him. I was either in vet school or in college, and we went to the Apple show to see him, and he was like super proud in his booth. Well, myfonts.com.
I got something to tell you about those early days in 1973, and I think this is where your penchant for liking alcohol comes from.
Yeah.
When they founded that company, they had an idea for the new, what they called electronic composition system, which was this type thing. And in 74, they created a prototype video display terminal, which was encased in a cardboard whiskey carton. So they took this terminal, but they didn't have a case, so they used a cardboard whiskey carton. And I just thought, well, that's appropriate.
I know. Well, my dad and my uncle don't drink, so I'm sure it was either Doug's.
It skipped a generation.
Or they got it. My white grandfather loved drinking, but if it was his, it would have been like a Pabst Blue Ribbon case.
Oh, really? It wouldn't have been a whiskey container.
No, my grandpa was a big beer drinker.
That's funny. So now they built this company, and then I assume they sold it at some point.
Yeah, they sold it like in the 80s.
So did he retire after that, or did he get into...
He retired, and he... I think he was like in his late 30s at the time. And he had been working really. I mean, my grandmother was like, you know, a slave driver. And he retired and he did some of the things that he'd always want to do. Like he learned to windsurf and he moved to Hawaii. That's when he moved to Hawaii.
Well, let's talk about, you were born in Massachusetts and was... what about your mom? Where did she come into the picture? Did he meet her at MIT?
She was a secretary there, I think.
Okay. So that's where you came along, huh?
Yeah, that's where I came along.
And they had developed this company up there, and he still had the company up there.
Oh, yeah. So we lived in Massachusetts I lived there until I was 17.
Okay. So you spent your whole growing up in Massachusetts.
Yep. And I rode.
I was going to ask, did you ride?
Yeah, I started riding when I was like, I don't remember starting to ride. I just remember riding. And I think
Were you doing hunters or what were you doing back then?
No, I think when I first started riding, my mother took me to like the local stable, and it was like if you look back now, it was probably like me as a vet, my worst nightmare client. Like it was just a dump. You know, with like shaggy ponies that are never brushed. I mean, not that that's not fun, but It was like, you know, the ponies were barely broke, may or may not have been broke.
It was not myopia.
No, it was not myopia. No, it was not. And then I was in 4-H, and
is that where your love of chickens comes and ducks comes
from? No, no, because our 4-H in Massachusetts was just a horsey one one barn was at. And so I was at this barn. It was a famous saddle seat barn, North Andover. And they had these huge saddlebreds. And I remember being so little. He was this guy that ran the barn. And he was like this old Irish guy that was always drinking this red drink, which I think was a, cranberry and vodka. He was drinking that all the time. And he never had enough help because they'd always quit because he would always be grabbing them. And so he'd yell to us, girls, come over here, head this horse. Because he was real fat, too. So it was hard for him to get into those little show carts. So we'd have to stand in front of these giant saddlebreds. And I could barely reach their bit. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And for those that don't know, Wendy's 5'2" on a good day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I remember being on my tippy toes and trying to hold on to this bit and thinking, God, if that thing steps on my toe. You know, because their feet are so huge. And then Eddie would yell, fire in the hole, and then you'd move, and then you'd go.
Fire in the hole.
Yeah.
Because when those saddlebreds take off, that's about what it's like.
I know. And like nowadays, you look at people with their kids, they're so overprotective. And I think my parents just left me with this drunk, like, guy that grabs any woman, doesn't matter what her age is, from 8 to 80, doesn't care. And we thought it was great. We loved to go to the barn. I mean, he was just like, he was totally harmless, you know?
Yeah.
Wasn't like he did anything. He was too drunk. Couldn't do it. And our parents would send us off in the van with him. He'd drive us to horse shows. And we used to love to get to ride in the van because it was an old horse box and the passenger side was like all rusted from all the salt on the road. So there's a big hole in the passenger side floor because they only fixed the horse part, but they didn't bother to fix the people part.
You're doing Flintstones.
You know, you had to keep your feet up. You had to keep.
Or you were doing Flintstones.
Yeah. I know. Isn't that ridiculous? And our parents thought that was great. Oh, Eddie's going to drive the girls to the show.
So that was your first welcome into horse into the horse community, Eddie.
Yeah, but he wasn't our trainer. I have to say, my trainer was this lady named Joy Kellett, who was super wonderful, and I still keep in touch with her on Facebook. She does harness racing now. She and her husband.
Oh, wow, cool.
Yeah, and they live in Maine, and then Joy. I think she had kids and she was retiring from teaching. So she sent us off to this woman named Pam Hunt, who's a hunter trainer in Haverhill.
So now did you get into showing at that point when you were still a teenager?
I showed a little bit. Like we showed at the Topsfield Fair. Remember the Topsfield?
Yeah, we went to the Topsfield Fair several times. Yeah.
And then when I started with Pam when I was 13, I guess. And then I started showing, like, you know, around Massachusetts, like, I'm going blank now, but we showed like zone level. I didn't show national level.
And did you always have in mind, well, let's do this. Let's take a break for a commercial and we'll come back. I want to find out when you started thinking that you might want to go to college and then become a veterinarian. So we'll be right back. We all get in a rut when it comes to shopping for horse supplies online. If you have not tried horselovers.com yet, then you are missing out on one of the world's largest online tack shops and all the best brands like Noble Outfitters, Ariat, Turn 2, Tough One, Professional's Choice, Weaver, and many, many more. Visit horselovers.com every day to see their daily deals and flash sales. Horselovers.com has everything for the Western and trail rider. So get on over to horselovers.com today and save. Go to college and then become a veterinarian. So we'll be right back. All right, we're back and we're talking to Dr. Wendy Ying, kind of doing a This Is Her Life story. And we're up to the point now, you're in high school, you're you're riding horses and doing all that. And I assume that, well, now we know, I don't have to assume. Now we kind of know where your super smarts come from, and that's from your dad.
Right.
And now your mom was not Chinese, though.
No.
She was from the United States.
Yep. She's like, you know, a mix of everything white.
Okay. All right, got it. So that's where your half Chinese comes from.
My mother is actually, you'll meet her sometime, I'm sure. She's like super crazy. And she, her name's Donna and her last name's Ying, obviously. And she used to, I remember she got this pink Jaguar and she went down to the DMV because she wanted to get vanity plates. Because, you know, they've made it now. Like, she's buying this Jaguar. She's going to get vanity plates. Because, you know, my parents both were not very wealthy. So after the whole ATEX thing, you know, they're like nouveau rich people. So you get your fancy car and you get your vanity plate. So she goes down there and she comes back and she has this license plate that says dying on her pink Jaguar. And we're like, what are you doing?
Like,
and
she's D-Y-I-N-G, dying?
Yeah, she goes, well, they didn't have Donna Y was already taken, so I did D-Ying.
But it spells dying.
She drove around, she probably still has that plate. She drove around like that for years. That's a ridiculous
story. So when did the idea to become a vet come into play?
Well, I was in college in California. I went to San Jose State for college.
How'd you end up out there? You just want the better weather?
Well, my dad was living in Los Altos.
Oh, yeah.
Which is like next to Palo Alto.
Yeah. So, where Apple is. Yeah.
Because he was like I told you, he was totally into this whole like new personal computer stuff. And he loved being in Silicon Valley because a lot of his friends from MIT had companies and, you know, they're pretty tight with each other there. So he liked it there. And the weather's awesome. I mean, the weather there every day, it's 75 degrees and sunny and no humidity. There's no bugs. It's like perfect. That's why, besides the computer people, Tiki, that's why the land there is so expensive. It really is perfect weather.
Mm-hmm.
So, I remember it snowed on Easter in Massachusetts. Okay, so it's like April 20th, and it started snowing. And I was like, I am getting the hell out of here. I didn't care where I was going or what I was doing. I called my dad. I said, I'm leaving here, like now. And he's like, great. Well, come on. So I left and I moved to California. I think I was 17 or 18. I can't remember. But in this town that he was living in, there was this, like all California towns have community colleges. And it was so cheap. My college was $33 a semester.
Whoa.
But my dad said, yeah, come out here because I've been paying property tax out here. You wouldn't believe how high the property tax is. He's like, we got to get our money back so you can go to college here. And we've already paid for it because that's what your taxes pay for, you know? So I went to college at this place called Foothill Community College. And it was so awesome because coming from Massachusetts, you know how Massachusetts is. It's very traditional and it's kind of woodsy and, you know, it's kind of boring scenery wise. And I got to California and there's like mountains everywhere. And Foothill was on the top of this mountain and it looked like a tiki village. It had thatched roofs and all the buildings were round and you didn't have any inside hallways because the weather's always perfect. So every little building was like six classrooms and you just walk or, you know, wait outside until it's your time for class. And I'm used to like these big brick, huge buildings with like pumped in air and it's cold and it's industrial. And I get to California and I just think, oh my God, this is paradise. What was I thinking?
And then you were in college, you were in community college and then went obviously to finish your 4 years.
But at that point, I still didn't know what I wanted to do.
Yeah, where did the whole veterinary thing come from?
I just took, that's why I went to community college too, because I didn't know what I wanted to do. So I didn't want to go, you know, make this big commitment. Well, you don't know what you want to be when you're 18.
No, you don't know what you want to be when you're 40.
Yeah, and I also started fox hunting then. That's when I started fox hunting, because I was boarding my horses at this barn in California called Webb Ranch. So anybody from that area would know Webb Ranch is probably equivalent to like the pony barn I started in riding in Massachusetts. But it actually was really cool because they had they grew a lot of vegetables and their own hay and blah, blah, blah. So they had a 99-year lease or something from Stanford University. So it was really affordable board. And there were like 300 horses there. It was kind of like a horse condo. So you board your horse, and the way they keep horses in California is like a stall and you have a tack closet and then like a little, your own private little turnout, which is like maybe 15 feet by 15 feet. And that's how they live. They don't get turned out. Huh. But this place had tons of trails because it was a farm, and then also it was near Stanford University. And it also had hosted the polo team for Stanford. So they had a huge irrigated polo field that we could ride on. And so my friend Peter Griffin, who actually teaches at Stanford, he's this crazy Irish guy that you'd think is like, you kind of think he's kind of spacey, like you, whenever he's talking to you, he doesn't listen. But he's super smart. He's like some kind of physicist or engineer or something. He's like the most published person I've ever known. And his girlfriend was my next door neighbor at the barn, Cynthia Edwards, who was a molecular biologist. So I'm hanging out with these two like super smart people, but I only knew them from the barn. And then Peter and I started fox hunting together, and I met all my fox hunting buddies. Remember, we had Erin on the show the other day?
Yeah.
She's one of my fox hunting buddies from California. And it kind of like opened up my mind about how, like, I didn't think I ever wanted to fox hunt. I only went because like my buddies were going. But I never even knew how fun it could be. And I started doing that. And I was like, oh, my God, this is so cool and dangerous and fun. And you can see all these cool places. So
I'll ask the question again. When did you decide to become a vet?
Oh, sorry. I got off the track on fox hunting. So I guess it is a horse show,
so it's okay to get off the track on horses. Yeah.
I guess when I was at that barn, there was like 300 horses there. And so you see, you know, before I was always in like a little barn with only like either a boarding stable where I didn't take care of my own horse. You know, you pay board and the manager runs the barn, or we had them in the backyard, but you don't see other horses. You know, you only see your own horses. At this stable, I saw like, I mean, there's all kinds of different levels of care people do and injuries and all this crazy stuff. I mean, there was a vet out there at least three times a day with 300 horses, you know? And so then I started riding with my vet there. And then that's another time you go and you see all kinds of stuff, you know, stuff that I had no idea about. Like natural horsemanship was just kind of starting to get rolling.
And it started out there, actually. So, yeah.
So it was kind of interesting because I was exposed to a lot of that. Plus, across the street from us was another farm where you could board, but it also had a lot of racehorses. And they had a rehab veterinary hospital there. They had a pool, and they had all kinds of cool stuff that I never even knew existed. So then I thought I could mix my love of science with horses.
And that's where it all started, huh?
That's where it all started. And I guess my parents said when I was little, I did want to be a vet. But we bred a lot of animals, too, like when I was a teenager. And, you know, I'm kind of sensitive. So I hate the death part, you know. I hate the euthanizing animals. And I think when I had to euthanize my pony, he had super bad laminitis. And I remember I was there and my mother said she couldn't stand to be there. So I had to go myself with the vet. And our vet was a wonderful guy, but he was kind of like rough around the edges guy. So I was there with the vet and the backhoe guy. And, you know, I know they were trying to be lighthearted about it because that's what you have to do in that situation. And that's how I am now. But I remember thinking, God, this sucks. I would never want to be a vet because I don't want to have to push him into that hole.
Yeah. You know, all of us have gone through that.
You know,
we've all gone through that.
Yeah. So that's when I stopped wanting to be a vet.
So where did you end up going to vet school? And you must have had darn good grades in college.
I had pretty good grades. I initially wanted to go to Davis because I was in California, but when I was interviewing, I applied to Davis, Cornell, Tufts. I actually was going to apply to University of Florida. I actually really, really wanted to go there, but remember there was like this guy murdering students there. Remember there was like
remember that.
There was some mass murderer there that was like picking off students. So my dad said I could not apply to University of Florida. So, and then I wanted to apply to Virginia because I was fox hunting a lot. And so I was like, oh, I should go to Virginia because I can fox hunt. And also the eventing and, you know, the hospital they have in Leesburg. I thought that would be really cool. But Virginia at the time didn't take out-of-state students.
Oh.
So I thought, oh, well, I'll apply to North Carolina because it's right next to Virginia. So maybe I can just go down and actually see what's going on in Virginia. And when I got to North Carolina for my interview, I saw it and I thought, oh, my God, what a hidden gem, because the school is so awesome. It's perfect for me because I can read the books, you know, and whatever. But what I really wanted was hands-on experience. And North Carolina, the hospital is attached to the classroom, to the school. So from day one, you can spend time in the hospital.
And where's the college?
It's in Raleigh, North Carolina. Yeah. And it's right in the city, but it's a big, huge farm. They have cows, chickens, pigs, goats. They have a horse breeding program where they breed quarter horses, and it's right across the street from the fairgrounds. And it's just a really wonderful school, but I wouldn't have known about it because it's not really, you know, when you think about vet schools, that's not one that just comes to your mind, you know?
So did you work during college or not?
No, I didn't work during college.
Did you work during vet school? Or no, it's hard to work during vet school.
No, you can't. Yeah, but yeah. I actually, during vet school, I started my Irish draft breeding farm.
Okay, so why Irish drafts? You got into Irish drafts.
Oh, God, this is a great story, actually. I didn't even remember this. Like, if you didn't ask me that. Okay, remember I told you how the fairgrounds was across the street?
Yep.
Remember we were talking to Dr. Fletcher, my dean. So... yes, he caught me when the fair was in town, but I also used to skip class a lot because they would have a lot of horse shows over there. But I mean, I wasn't skipping important stuff, you know, it's just like, it's lecture and they were just reading off the slides. So I didn't miss any labs, but they were having this huge dressage show over there. And I was like, oh, I want to go to the dressage show. So I left and I walked over there and then, I was watching the dressage show for a while. And then, one of my friends said, oh, you got to go see the stallion auction. They're having a stallion auction. So I walked over to the stallion auction and there were these two Irish draft stallions that somebody had donated and nobody had bid on them. And I was like, oh, I feel so bad for these people. And one was super cute. It looked like a giant Welsh pony. Okay. So I said, oh, I'm going to put my name down because I feel bad for these people. So I just put my name down. Like I put down $100 for the bid because I thought it would help get things going. So then like the next day they call me and they said I won both of the stallions.
For $200.
Yeah, and I was like, oh, great. Well,
so you're still in vet school and now you have two horses?
I was still in vet school. I had
stallions.
My... No. It was just a breeding. Oh, you didn't get the horses.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. Okay. Gotcha. And then you really stayed in Irish Drafts from that point on.
I did. I was very involved with Irish Drafts for a while, and I really, I'm sad that I stopped doing that because I like the breed a lot. One of the reasons I really like it is, in this country, it's hard to find like a all around horse that's not a quarter horse. And I'm not against quarter horses, but they have a lot of problems like with their feet and genetically, and that's just not my type of horse. But I thought, how can people go to Ireland that can't even ride? And I see all these pictures. They went like trekking and they went fox hunting and they took their husband who doesn't ride and blah, 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 have a great time. And I'm like, why is it in America it's so hard to find a nice horse that doesn't want to kill you, right? And like Beaker.
Yeah, right.
You know, yeah. Beaker is a great horse, but there's not a ton of Beakers around. And so... then once I started researching the Irish Draft, I was like, well, this is what we need in the United States, more all-arounders. But the problem was is that getting them over here was just so expensive that it kind of priced them out of the market that they really should be selling to.
Did you know, so was that something that you were still riding at this point? You weren't driving at this point, right?
No, I wasn't driving. I was riding and I was... My goal was because I was really into repro, equine repro. That's what I really wanted to do when I was in school. And so my goal was I was going to start breeding these Irish Drafts. And then someday I was going to have an Irish Draft farm where I would train the babies to be fox hunters and all arounders and blah, 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 sell the babies. But like I said, to bring them over, the cost to produce the babies, you had to sell them at like 20 grand to cover your cost, you know, and a 20 grand horse is not when you can buy a draft cross for $3,500 for a fox hunter. Why would you buy a $20,000 Irish draft? You know? So I wasn't too good at business.
Really good at smarts, not so good at business.
And you know what else happened at that point? The people, the Gypsy King people, you know, the Gypsy banners. There's a guy in Ocala. He has Gypsy King.
Yes.
Those people started bringing over gypsies.
And they were flashier.
Well, they were flashier and they also were smart enough to bring over the pretty ones, you know, because they have to have a pretty head. And in Ireland, they don't. But they could buy those horses for, you know, meat prices and bring them over. Whereas we were paying, you know, not a ton of money, but we're paying a couple thousand for Irish Drafts.
Intend to fly them over.
Yeah. So the gypsies actually, Irish Drafts, while they are wonderful, they can be kind of stubborn. So the buyer you attract with the Irish Draft is like a very, it could be somebody's first horse of their own or their beginner person, and they're drawn to that breed because they are so easy. But sometimes the Irish Draft temperament, you have to imagine they're like giant ponies. So there are some that are bratty, and if they know they can take advantage of their person, they might do that for fun. You know,
you had a couple of those.
Yeah, but I like that temperament.
Where was your first job after this? I don't know. We've talked about a lot of stuff, but what was your first vet job?
My first vet job, I graduated from school and I started my own goat practice. And there were these goats.
Okay, let's say that again. You started your own what?
Goat practice.
Okay.
This is another great story.
It's not what I expected.
When I was in my, I can't believe it. Maybe you're right. My life is super crazy. Okay, this is what happened. I was in my second to last year of vet school. Okay. And I went to Ireland. This is my biggest regret of my life. I went to Ireland And I went on the mare tour, like they do inspections, right? You drive all over Ireland and you go and inspect the mares and you look at their confirmation, blah, blah, blah. And they pass, fail, whatever. They get their breeding license. So I went all over Ireland with these two old Irish guys. It was so much fun. I learned so much. I learned so much in that week about horses that, I mean, you'll never learn that unless you go hang out with a bunch of old horse guys that just look at confirmation all day. But so I met this vet there and he offered me this job. He said, well, when you're done with school, you come out here, I'll give you a house and you can come and, because he was getting old then. And he said I could work with him. And then when he's ready to retire, I could take his practice.
You could be living in Ireland and retired by now.
I know. And I didn't do it. And you know why? Because I was scared. And I had already moved all over the place, but I had never lived out of the United States. I still never have lived outside the United States.
So that was the reason you didn't, just because of you were scared?
I was scared. Like I would have to sell everything. I'd have to get rid of all my horses. I, at this point, still had my Irish draft plan. And
which you could have done very well in Ireland.
I know. But I don't know. And I had this long-term boyfriend and, you know, we had plans, but I think now back to it, I should have just left everything. I should have just sold it all and walked away and gone there because it would have been such an adventure. And if it didn't work out, it's not like I couldn't come back. It's not like I'm exiled from the United States. I just went to Ireland. So I didn't do that. And then after that, I think that made a big impression on me of my decisions since then. Like, that's why sometimes it looks like I'm just kind of
doing stuff.
yeah. And I get this call from this guy, Alan, who I know from the Irish draft world. And he says, Wendy, I've got this great job for you. I want you to come be my vet at the farm because I am starting this embryo transplant business with Irish drafts. And he's like, I have a stallion and I have four mares. Did you say four mares? Yeah. And he has four mares. And he said, if I can collect 8 embryos from these four mares, that's 32 babies a year. And if I can sell these babies for $20,000 a piece, that's like whatever 32 is times 20,000. So he's like, and I'm thinking, well, that's great, but it's not going to work like that. You know, there's a lot of ups and downs in breeding and blah, 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 blah. And he also had these recipients. They were Belgians. He had these great, big, huge Belgian mares that he got from the Amish. So the first problem I said you have is you only have 20 acres and you want to have like a gazillion horses and babies. And I said, second of all, you can only assume that 50% of the time the mare cycles, you're going to get a baby. And then, you know, there's lots of things that can happen between then. And he goes, but listen, I can't fail. I said, why? He goes, I can't fail because I'm led by God. God told me to do this.
So you signed right up.
No, I didn't sign up.
When?
I didn't. I wanted to. But so I said, Alan, you're crazy. When God told you to get into Irish drafts, he meant beer, not horses.
He would have made a lot more money. So.
But so. No, this story gets better. Oh. It gets better. I didn't take the job with him. I get a call 3 months later. Okay. I think I was at Southern Pines. I think I was showing at my first driving show. And Alan goes, oh, no, it wasn't Alan. It was the police. And they said it was the police from the area. Alan had been hauled off to jail for animal cruelty. And his partners were all trying to take whatever was left from the farm. And the bank had repossessed everything. And they had these two kids standing guard at the gate. Trying to stop these people coming to try to take the animals and the stuff at the farm, and that they didn't know what to do because all of the records all of the records for all the horses was in Spanish and in vet shorthand, because he had hired this Colombian guy to come be the vet when, after I said no. So they couldn't tell which babies were, they couldn't tell any of the pedigrees, and they didn't know which ones, which babies were in which recipients. So they called, the bank called me to come out and to go through all the records and to identify all the babies so they could sell them and get their money back.
You could have gone to jail if you'd worked with this guy.
No, I was hired by the bank.
No, you could have gone to jail if you'd went to work with this guy in the beginning.
I'd be in jail. I'd be in jail now. But he went bankrupt, and then also he got in trouble for animal cruelty because the horses look awful and they're dead babies. Like, they were.
That was a terrible story. Yeah.
It was awful.
Horse people know that they can count on Ovation's value, quality, and style when it comes to hard-wearing schooling attire, affordable show gear for horse and rider, or top-of-the-line equipment for riders at every level. From breeches to bridle work, saddles to stock ties, helmets to half chaps, Ovation is the premier brand of riding apparel and equipment for you and your horse in the United States, outfitting riders at every level from head to toe. Ask for Ovation brand riding helmets, breeches, and footwear at your local tack store, or go online to ovationriding.com and see the fantastic variety of quality, fashion-forward, affordable products from Ovation. ovationriding.com.
Tell everybody, and I know the answer to this, tell everybody the most unique wheeled vehicle, horse-drawn wheeled vehicle you ever owned and how you got it.
Oh, the Stagecoach?
Could you tell that story? Yeah.
Yes. All right. Well, you know, my dad has like a lot of weird friends. So one of his weird friends is an artist. And I'm using that term very loosely. But he's a super good guy. And he's a furniture maker. He makes actually beautiful furniture. So his art's a little weird. But his furniture is beautiful. So he decided he was going to make stagecoaches because he made his first one. And I think he had a neighbor that had quarter horses and they wanted to go into the Rose Bowl parade. And so they took the stagecoach with 6 quarter horses and they did the Rose Bowl parade. And he got to dress up like a cowboy. He was all excited. And then some Japanese guy came and bought it for like $200,000. So now he's like, oh, if I can sell these stagecoaches, it's kind of like this Allen guy with the Irish drafts. I can sell these stagecoaches for $200,000. I'm going to make 10 of them. So he makes all these stagecoaches, and they are beautiful. I mean, really gorgeous. But he didn't sell any. So he ended up going bankrupt for something, and my dad bailed him out. And he goes, oh, Charlie, I've got a great deal for you. Your daughter drives. How about I pay you back some of the money that I owe you by giving you this stagecoach? It's worth $200,000. So unfortunately, my dad believed that. So he's like, okay, fine. Because he probably knew he was never going to get his money back, right? At least gets a stagecoach. So I'm living in Virginia at the time. And my dad's like, oh, look. Irving sending you this stagecoach.
To pull with your little ponies.
Yeah. And he's like, yeah, you can drive it with your horses. And I'm like, okay, this thing is gigantic. And I drive a 14-hand single. And this is for her.
It'd be like on, what's the Christmas? The Grinch. It'd be like on the Grinch with the dog pulling the sleigh. The
He doesn't know. And I think he's like paying attention when I tell him stories about my life, but obviously no. So the stagecoach shows up and I was like, great. So luckily I had a barn to put it in. I put it in the barn and it kind of sat in there. How am I going to pull it? I don't even have four-hand harness. I don't have anything. The only thing we pulled it with was a tractor when we moved it, like, from the truck.
Was it in good shape, the stagecoach?
Oh, yeah, it was gorgeous.
So here you are. You have the thing that that drivers for years and years and years all want to have eventually as their kind of fantasy thing. And yeah, you've got it with no horses and no harness.
No, but we would sometimes like have little farm tours. We'd look at it. So what was I going to do with it? I didn't know how to drive forehand. At this point, Glenn, I had no idea how to even hook up the carriage like that. So Paul May lived down the road from me. He worked for Sandy Lerner, and she had Shires, and she had all these commercial vehicles and all kinds of things. And so he calls me one day. I think he was moving to a new job. And I was sending the stagecoach to Martin's. So he says, okay, before that stagecoach goes, I have to bring the horses up because I've always wanted to drive a stagecoach. And I said, cool, because I've always wanted to drive the stagecoach, but I don't have the horses. So he brings up the four horses, the four Shires. They were huge, big black Shires.
Oh, wow.
And Dee was working for him at the time. You know, Dee and Tristan?
Yep.
So Dee came up. Yeah. So
who would actually know how to hook up a stagecoach?
Yeah.
Without dying.
Help. We didn't know. So we hook up the stagecoach and we were driving around where I lived. It has all these dirt roads where you can drive. I mean, you can do coaching for miles out there. And so we hooked up the stagecoach and we went driving around the neighborhood, and it was super fun.
I bet. You have a picture of that too, because I think I remember seeing the picture, don't you?
We have a super old picture because it was before we had iPhones.
But you scanned it in, didn't you? Didn't you send it
I
to
did,
me one time?
Yeah.
You'll have to send that to me again, and I'll use it as the show notes picture for this episode, is you and the stagecoach.
Yeah, because I think Dee took the picture of us. It's really grainy, but I do have that picture.
So and how much did the $200,000 stagecoach sell for at Martin's?
It went for pretty good money. It sold for $35,000.
Well, that's not bad. Yeah, not 200, so
it was
but
pretty good.
It's pretty
good. It wasn't a reproduction. You know, it was the problem was he gave me the one with the fiberglass body, which was good for pulling. You know, that's actually great because it was lighter. But if it had a wood body, it probably would have gone for more. And I'm glad I sold it because actually the market in carriages has gone down so much.
Yeah.
You know, so at the time it was probably good. And I was moving to Florida. So I thought, God, you know, it's bad enough. I have a couple retired horses I have to drag with me, but now I have to drag this stagecoach with me too.
And this
so I need
probably
to lighten up my load.
We've told a lot of the stories on the driving radio show, and you can go back through the past episodes of when Wendy got into four in hand and the WEG experience and all of that. So we're kind of almost up to that point, but there's one story I want you to tell before we wrap up here today, now that you've all learned about the early life of Wendy Ying. There's one story I want you to tell, and it comes back to your dad again, who I am very sorry. He died a few years ago, right? Right before I met you.
In 2010, yeah, right? Yeah. Like 2 weeks before.
I know. It was right around the time I met you, actually.
Yeah.
So there was a story, though, of a mutual friend of ours. There was this girl named Rochelle. She's British. And
that's a great story.
Yeah, I got to tell the story because it's so bizarre.
Okay.
Rochelle worked with my wife at Myopia Hunt Club. She worked for my wife at Myopia Hunt Club when Jennifer was the manager there. And she did lessons, and she's just super nice, and she's British, and she always wanted to become a vet, which she has since then. Yeah. And we've had her on the show many times, actually, talking about vet life in... Which country was that?
She went to
Slovakia
Hungary.
Or something. It was Slovakia, I think. So she was in vet school in this one of these ex-Eastern Bloc countries, and she was telling about life doing that and not understanding a word they were saying. And so she has become a vet, and I think she's in England now. We have to get her back on. But so she lived in Massachusetts, and but you also knew her, right?
She worked for Larry Poulin for many, many years.
She was
so
a groom
I knew her from driving.
Driver. Right.
She was Larry Poulin was a pair driver, and she worked for him at the shows. And also, he went to many world championships. So she used to fly all around with the horses. And I knew her, you know, from.
And she's kind of like you. If Rochelle was around, you knew her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, super nice.
Yeah, kind of like you that way. You know, everybody knows Wendy. Well, everybody knew Rochelle. All right, now that leads us to your dad. So tell us, this has to be shortly before he died, right?
Because he was at Mass General for the summer doing this experimental treatment. So he had to be close to the hospital. So he rented a house in Marblehead, and it was right on the water. And it was this cute little house. And he's sitting there drinking coffee on the porch and looking in the ocean. And my dad was like a ladies' man too. He really likes, you know, beautiful girls. And he doesn't care how old he is. You know, they're best if they're like between 20 and 28, you know. So all of a sudden he said, I was drinking my coffee on the porch and this beautiful girl comes out of the water. She was scuba diving. And she's looking at me and she walks right over. It was like a mermaid walking out of the sea to me. And she says, hey, aren't you Wendy Ying's dad? And he's like, what? I am Wendy Ying's dad, but how does this mermaid know?
He must have thought the chemo was like messing with him. That's every guy's fantasy right there is a mermaid walks out and knows you.
I know. Aren't you Wendy Ying's dad? It's like, that puts a real damper on the whole like, his fantasy going on here. And so this is what, like, it was 2010 or 2000. It was either 2009, 2010, but we were like pretty active on Facebook. So she had seen all the pictures of me with my dad on Facebook. So that's how she recognized him, and she knew the house. So that's why it's so funny.
Yeah.
But also, my dad had a friend that he used to ski with all the time in Colorado. And that guy's daughter went to Harvard with Zuckerberg, Facebook guy.
Yeah.
And so my dad was actually one of the first people on Facebook before it was open to everybody. It was still Harvard University kids.
Oh, wow.
I know.
Well, I love hearing that story, especially because I've heard it from both sides. We actually have heard it from her side and his side. So, and the story is exactly the same.
It is.
Rochelle's told that story, too, when she knew you were working with us.
Did she know how sad he was? That she said?
No, I don't think she realized that the fantasy was gone. I don't think that. That's funny. I didn't hear that quite version before, but it is every guy's fantasy, right? Oh, that's funny. And to see somebody coming out on the beach and then walk up to you and say, I think I know who you are. That'd be freaky. That's just like out of the movies.
I know.
And did she recognize him anyway?
I think she knew the house.
Oh, okay.
You know, from Facebook, she seen that we were in Massachusetts.
Ah, got it. Okay.
So I think she probably knew kind of where we were, because that's a really small area. Town is tiny.
That's funny. She loves the water. I don't know. She always wanted to work with sea animals too when she became a vet. So I hope Rochelle ends up doing that.
She needs to come down to Sarasota then.
Yeah, we need to get Rochelle back on. Well, maybe we'll get her on our show on the Driving Radio Show and chat with her about what she's up to now, one vet to another. Well, Wendy, thank you so much for joining us today. We've run out of time, but as I said, this pretty much gets us up to the point on time when we started talking about Wendy's history on the Driving Radio Show. And if you want to hear all of that, you can go back to past episodes of the Driving Radio Show at drivingradioshow.com or horseradionetwork.com. But and if you've never listened to the Driving Radio Show, we've changed the format a little bit in the last couple of weeks, just like we did Stable Scoop. We've changed driving. It's every 2 weeks now. And we are doing a driving interview because we've gotten so much feedback from listeners that they love when Wendy talks about veterinary stuff and Chinese medicine stuff, that we have now changed the format a little bit. It's still the Driving Radio Show, but we'll do one driving guest at the beginning, and then half the show is a driving guest, and half the show is about Chinese medicine or veterinary medicine. And the show's a little bit shorter now than it was before, so I think you'll enjoy it. And if you've missed past Chinese medicine segments that Wendy's done. Most of them are over at Horse Tip Daily. You can just go to Horse Tip Daily and put in search for Dr. Wendy Ying, and it'll bring up all the past episodes of the Chinese medicine segments that she's done. And there's been some fascinating stuff. So,
you know what I like about the new format? I really like the that I get to interview other vets, because I think that format's working better.
It is.
And it's interesting for me. It's more interesting for me than to just like talk, research something and talk about it.
I never have much to add, so I'm not much help.
Oh. Yeah.
But you know what?
But I get to interview these fun people and find out things that I never knew. I mean, that's part of the fun of interviewing people, is you find out, you get to be nosy and ask them all these details about what they're doing.
We did that one on Lyme, you know, and then we met your dean in the last episode. So that was a lot of fun. So you'll need to have two ready for Wednesday. We have to record ahead because of vacation.
I have two great ones. We have cataracts and we have, turmeric life, Dr. Doug English.
Yes. Yep.
We have the Australian vet about turmeric.
Very good. That's all coming up on the Driving Radio Show. And also, Wendy has a blog, and you can find, where can they find the blog and also your store?
At drwendyying.com.
Well, thank you, everybody, for joining us and hanging out with Wendy.